Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day. This episode of Big T Trauma is sponsored by Teleflex, a global provider of medical devices that address the time-critical challenges of achieving vascular access and bleeding control. Not all products are available in all regions. To learn more, visit teleflex.com.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife. I'm Patrick Georgioff, and I'm happy to say that this is another Big T Trauma episode. They happen to be my favorite. And today, we're taking a swing at a topic that's essential, but often anxiety-provoking, and that's pediatric trauma. Kids are not just little adults. They crash harder, they hide shock better, and they will certainly humble you. Today, we're joined by my co-host, Dr. Teddy Puzio, who is staff at UT Houston. He's a regular on our Big T series. And we have two special guests. First is Dr. Chuck Cox, professor of pediatric surgery at UT Houston and a true expert in the world of pediatric trauma. And Dr. Paul Ramsuchet, who is a second-year trauma fellow at UT Houston. Welcome y'all to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. I've been a huge fan since intern year. You guys have definitely gotten me out of a ton of sticky situations. And so in today's one of two-part episode, we're going to dive into pediatric trauma pitfalls. And we're going to do this through some real-life case scenarios. Today, particularly, we're going to focus on the ABCs of P trauma, as well as some of the unique anatomy and physiology that they have.
Let's get started with this first. Toddlers dropped off in the ambulance bay after reportedly being involved in a high-speed rollover MVC. He was unrestrained in the back seat, was ejected from the vehicle. Your vitals, Paul, heart rate's 120. BP is 98 over 60. They have cool extremities and no external bleeding. You complete a rapid and complete primary survey. They start having some difficulty breathing. Nasal cannula and a non-rebreather mask aren't cutting it, so the ED moves to intubate him. Everyone's getting ready to do the thing, and everyone starts asking about RSI med dosing. You know, have we gotten the weight? What's the patient's age again? How tall are they? And someone went running off to find the Braslow tape as well. Unfortunately, during that time, the patient starts to desaturate and really begins to drop precipitously. Paul, what could we have done differently in this scenario to prevent this patient's respiratory issues?
This one makes me anxious just hearing it. I'm not going to lie. It's real. We can all feel it. I think even hearing you describe the vitals, people are probably going, wait, are those normal in a kid, right?
Yeah. In adults, there's a lot more leeway with estimating or standardized dosing, but in peds, every single medication or almost every medication is weight-based. And so you need to know the dosing and, more importantly, the weight or the estimated weight of your patient. And so if you're not ready with a system in place before they roll in through the door, you're already behind.
Yeah. Such an important part of trauma, right? Huddle your team, assign roles, get your equipment ready. So what could we have done before this kid even got to the bay, especially knowing that pediatric trauma makes us all nervous?
Yeah, I think it's really exactly what you just said. Get your system in place and get your team ready. And particularly for this scenario, it's having something that you can refer to immediately for pediatric patients, whether it's a Braslow tape or using the Hantevi system that we have in Houston, just having something ready. And it helps to have the code carts with all the critical meds you need that are already categorized by weight.
How does that work? Tell us how you apply that in real life scenario.
Yeah, of course. So there's two major ways to estimate weight-based dosing in peds, and it's either the Braslow tape or the Hantevi system. They're both used for kids that are up to age 12 or 36 kilos. And so with the Braslow tape, it's a physical color-coded tape that gets laid next to the patient, usually on the stretcher that they get rolled over to. And whatever color the heels measure to gives you the common medication doses for that height, as well as the appropriate catheters and tubes for that patient size. And the resus carts are also color-coded. So whatever color that corresponds to on the patient's height is the drawer that you open, and it has all your meds with the appropriate doses for that. The Hantevi is similar to the Braslow tape in the sense that it's color-coded and corresponds. However, the main difference is that it's age-based instead of height-based.
Yeah, here we use the Hantevi, and is age based. And so if a level one's paged out, we can use that age to get the room ready. Gives you pre-calculated drug doses, fluid volumes, equipment sizes, like endotracheal tubes, Foley catheter size, all that. So that part of the initial activity isn't taken up by just that chatter of trying to, what size NG tube should we put in? Yeah. And the Breslow tape works well too. It's a color-coded scheme. When the patient's laid down on the stretcher, it gives you a quick estimate, and on it, it has the doses laid out already. And a lot of EMSs will use one or the other of these.
So in this case, had we known that, we would have had the right medication doses, the right equipment available for intubation, and potentially could have avoided this episode of desaturation. Let's go on, Paul, to the next case. EMS rolls in with a five-year-old pedestrian who is struck by an F-150. He has devastating mid-face trauma, profuse oral pharyngeal bleeding, and swelling as well. And EMS says they tried to secure the airway but got lost in bleeding and soft tissue swelling. GCS is 6, SATs are 88%, and bagging is difficult. And once you get into the bay, attempts are made to visualize the cords. You can't see anything. And between multiple suctions, bag valve mass, we're losing the fight, and oxygen saturation is hovering in the low to mid-80s. And now the patient drops precipitously. They become bradycardic with that hypoxia and arrest. Terrible situation, a frightening one. What went wrong here?
Yeah, it's such a scary situation. And this is a true can't ventilate, can't oxygenate problem. And it really requires immediate what's called front of neck access. I think the team probably spent a little too long trying to get orotracheal access. And now the child's coding and decompensating rather quickly. I think we should have opted for a crike or a cricothyroidotomy pretty early on, and not just any crike. This is a five-year-old, so he needs a needle crike.
Bah, right? Crazy. Talking about needle crikes with adult trauma surgeons. We're going to get into that and break that down. So let's reset here. Work through the pediatric airway one step at a time, because again, this is where a lot of folks freeze, especially when you're thinking about a non-standard or non-adult approach to a crike.
Yeah. So hypoxia is the number one cause of pediatric arrests and trauma. And it's hard because everything's just different in kids. The occiput's larger, the epiglottis is a lot floppier, and the airway is positioned in such a way that it's much more anterior as opposed to adults. And obviously, the trachea is a lot shorter.
Yeah.
So with intubating, the real key here is to follow a checklist. And I use the 6 P's. First one's preparation. Have all the equipment you need. Yank hour, meds like we talked about earlier, multiple sizes of ET tubes, multiple different laryngoscopes, preferably a video, bougie, all the adjuncts you could think of, and definitely an extra set of hands. After you have all this preparation done, pre-oxygenate. Get the adjuncts in, start using your bag valve mask, suction if you need to. And remember, these are kids, so they need small tidal volumes or else you'll really overbag them. Once they're pre-oxygenated, then you start thinking about pre-treatment and paralysis. These kids need rapid sequence intubation. And like we talked about, the doses are weight-based. Finally, with placement, this should be the most experienced person in the room getting the tube in. Use the bougie if the airway's too anterior, and when you're passing the bougie, always be sure to feel the clicks of the tracheal rings as you're passing it through to make sure you're in the trachea. The videoscope is certainly your best friend, and when you're worried about a floppy epiglottis, you should reach for the Miller blade. And then finally, the last important thing to know is the tongue is a lot larger in kids, and it will cause your airway to get obstructed. And then once you've got all of this done, you're high-fiving, you got to make sure that you verify post-intubation with either end-tidal, chest x-ray, auscultation, or really any combination of those.
Paul, you mentioned the 6 P's. I like to preach, and I remember the 7 P's that I learned way back when I did EMS training. So proper pre-planning prevents piss-poor performance, right? And I think it's important. It applies to a lot of these things that we talk about. You can't, in the moment, go through this checklist if you've never preemptively thought about it, right? And that leads to the next scenario or the next phase of this scenario. So let's say you do all this stuff and the kid codes, and now you have to do a needle crike. How do you do a needle crike? And an important part of this is talking through it and thinking through it ahead of time. And that's why we're having this discussion. So Dr. Cox, you're the most qualified by far of all of us to walk us through this. So help us understand how you do one of these.
Yeah. Nice. You can call it needle crike. It can also be needle trach as well. I don't think you lose any points if the needle goes into the trachea. You're not going to hurt anything with that. But the reality is cricothyroidotomies are impractical in children just due to the very small membrane and space that makes it, especially in an emergency situation, just impractical. And so the idea is to access the airway with a 14 gauge angiocath angled at 45 degrees, caudally aspirating as you insert it. It's not far. And then you connect to an oxygen source that, and different places have different setups, but the idea is that you have quick bursts of oxygen with passive exhalation.
Practically speaking, is there an age? You often hear 8 years old as a cutoff. Is there roughly an age that you follow, or
I think that's a fair cut point for doing that. Even the smallest ET tube would get you over the hump. Even a 2.5 or 3 French ET tube would get you over the hump for that brief period of time.
All right. So with that, this is transtracheal jet ventilation, not that common. Dr. Cox, can you describe some of the more common setups and help paint a picture for people listening on the podcast? Because it may not be something that most folks have seen.
Yep. There's two common pieces of gear that you'll run across in managing this. One has a pressure regulated line that comes out of off the wall or an oxygen tank and has a handheld triggering device that you can connect to the cath with a three-way stopcock, and you squeeze and release. And it's a short burst of gas in and a longer exhalation. So your I to E ratio is 1 to 4 or something, maybe even potentially longer than that, because it's a rapid influx of gas and then exhalation. And then the other is just the oxygen coming straight off the wall or off of a tank that's connected to your three-way stopcock, that's connected to your angiocath. And then you can either manually control that with the tube and then in the inflow, outflow with your thumb on the three-way stopcock.
Yeah, so you're just putting your finger over that third piece of the lure lock connector there. And if you have your finger on top of it, gas is going to flow at that high pressure, pure oxygen into the airway, into your catheter. When you take it off, it'll preferentially flow out of your stopcock as opposed to the higher resistance catheter and into the lungs, and that allows exhalation to occur. All right, great. So with that, don't forget your 6 P's for pediatric airway, for all airways really: preparation, pre-oxygenation, paralysis, placement, and post-intubation confirmation. And remember that you're looking at roughly 8 years old as a cutoff for airways that are too small to do a classic open crike, and where you might want to consider a needle cricothyrotomy for gent ventilation. Let's go on to the next scenario. You have a 6-year-old boy. They're brought in after being struck by a car while crossing the street. EMS reports that the patient was awake at the scene, crying, and had a few abrasions on the legs. There's no loss of consciousness. Now, though, in the trauma bay, he's quiet but alert. Heart rate's 142, blood pressure's 90 over 60. Respiratory rate is 26. Cap refill is 4 seconds. And the child's not moving much. They're a bit lethargic. They're not crying. He's got some gauze wrapped around his head. EMS said there's quite a bit of blood loss at the scene. And when it's taken down, there's a large scalp plaque. FAST is negative. There's 2 IVs. The patient gets 250 cc's of LR, and a pan scan is ordered. However, the patient codes. Paul, what did we miss here? There's a big, bad miss. This is an unfortunate one.
Yeah, definitely. This is hard to hear. I think this is...
It is uncomfortable reading it, to be honest with you. I'm reading SDM going the whole time, like it hurts my soul.
Yeah. It's classic for compensated shock, especially in a pediatric patient. And it got missed completely. Everything about this case tells you that the kid's in trouble, but it's really subtle because they compensate and compensate. But some of the subtleties, he's tachycardic, he's cool, he had delayed cap refill, but the whole time his blood pressure was quote unquote normal. And that is the trap. Kids are really good at maintaining perfusion until they suddenly come off the cliff and crash. And by the time hypotension is showing up, you're late in the game.
So I think if we talk about things as black and white, that's a core difference, right? Adults show early signs of shock with hypotension, but in kids, they compensate way longer, like a machine.
Right. Pediatric patients, they just have an incredible sympathetic reserve, and they are really good at vasoconstricting, selectively shunting blood, and maintaining an adequate cardiac output. But when they decompensate, it is rapid and catastrophic. So 1 minute they're talking, and unfortunately the next minute they're coding.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Why don't we go into a little deeper dive in terms of what makes their physiology unique?
Sure. First and foremost, their blood volume is higher per kilo. It's about 80 mLs per kilogram. So that makes the absolute volume smaller. For example, a 20 kilogram child only has about 1.5 liters of total blood. And so losing a few hundred cc's is equivalent to losing basically a liter of blood in an adult. Also, when you think about their cardiac output, it's very rate dependent. They can't, for lack of a better term, stroke volume their way out of shock. And so their heart rate goes up, their perfusion takes a major hit and drops. That also means, though, that when you start to see the things that are altered mentation, decreased cap refill, certainly hypotension, and you're already behind the eight ball.
So remember, blood is king, right? So the best thing that we can do for a bleeding patient, child or adult, is to get blood products into them as quickly as possible. And when we talk about balanced resuscitation in adults, it's the same in kids, right? 1-to-1-to-1 ratio until you hit the endpoints like hemodynamics and PEGs improve or that bleeding's controlled. If you don't have rapid access to blood and the child is crashing, you can start with a 20 ml per kg bolus of crystalloid. But remember, when giving blood, the amount you need to replace their entire blood volume is proportional to their weight. And that's an important point. We'll put a link to a table at the end of this podcast with our UT pediatric massive transfusion protocol algorithm that can help guide you. But before we move on this topic, before I forget, let's talk a little bit about TXA. That's part of our MTP protocol. So in this patient population of bleeding hemorrhagic shock, they get 15 milligrams per kilogram IV of TXA in a bolus form over 10 minutes. And that's followed by 2 milligrams per kilogram an hour over 8 hours. And we always try to give it within 3 hours of injury.
Sure. And this raises the ultimate point. What about IV access? Dr. Cox, what kind of tips and tricks do you have for access in a pediatric trauma patient?
Now, so the same principle, the 2 large bore IVs obviously apply, but just recognize that large in an infant can be a 22 gauge. And the toughest kids are the kind of chunky 6-month-old, 8-month-old roly-poly kid who has these fat arms and thighs, and then its skin dives down to their wrist, and they have these big fat hands. And
I mean, yeah, super cute.
Yeah. It is just not easy. And then if they're in shock, it's even harder. And in children's hospitals, the number of people are really good at getting those with ultrasound guided, even in trauma resuscitation. But without that, and the child is decompensating, the IO line in the tibia is your friend. There are IO kits for that. Ping for infants, Blue for larger kids. I think the tibia is superior, but sometimes they have fractures. They're proximal fractures, so that's not a viable option. And the humerus is right here, and the humerus is where you get to immunization is a similar next best site. I think the third, central access can be a little bit more tedious, but I think that even a less recognized site is the saphenous vein in terms of saphenous vein cut down, which is a durable and predictable anatomic location of a decent sized vessel that takes a little bit longer, but is something that works really well with almost zero real morbidity associated with it. IJ, I think, is much more difficult in the smaller kid to be done in a trauma room. Femoral vein is reasonably straightforward, but in a hypotensive small child, then that can be, especially with a lot of activity on in that space, can be difficult.
Yeah, IOs can be lifesavers here. And practically speaking, what's your cutoff between the pink and blue intraosseous catheters? You said pink for infants, blue for kids.
Oh, six months to 12 months. I don't know what the actual package insert says, but if you have a greater than a 5 to 10 kilo kid, you would go to the blue.
Sure. All right, Teddy, for this scenario, what's the key takeaways?
Kids crash hard and fast. So pediatric patients in shock, they look fine, and then boom, they're suddenly periarrhythmic. So we need to pick up on those subtle findings, like tachycardia, cool extremities, delayed cap refill, altered mental status. These are all red flags that should start triggering your spidey senses, right? There's other adjuncts to look for. So a drop in end-tidal CO2, an increased lactite. These are sometimes early markers of hemorrhage. You have to recognize the signs of compensated shock early. Escalate to blood, right? Blood. Activate your MTP protocol. Hopefully there's a role for TXA in your protocols. And then if you wait for hypotension, you've already missed the boat. You shouldn't wait to get to that point before you start intervening.
All right, Dr. Cox, you have another scenario for us?
Yeah, let's do a quick scenario highlighting some management of pediatric thoracic trauma. So a two-year-old girl comes in after a fall to the second-story balcony. She's tachypneic, oxygenating poorly, has diminished breath sounds on the left. FAST shows a left-sided hemothorax. Chest x-ray confirms a moderate hemothorax with some mediastinal shift. The trauma team decides to place a chest tube, and then now cue the scramble for size, sedation, and setup. And so some of the nuances, first, obviously, is size, right? So it's not a 36 French chest tube for everybody. That is mandated in some.
So this day and age, you're talking 28 French or smaller, but that's
Let's not go down that.
No.
Wow. I've always recognized that the adult trauma team has gotten softer over the years. But now I've got a number to put on it. And so that's been helpful for me. Thank you. The first thing is size, and usually a 12 to 20 French chest tube. These are obviously smaller bore. In the smallest kids, smaller bore surgical tubes or pigtail catheters are popular. The landmarks are the same, except for a few differences. The pleura is thinner, and the thoracic cavity is smaller, which means your margins for error are less. You don't insert your finger into the chest. That's called a thoracotomy on the infant. And so it can be a little bit more tedious to get the tube between the rib spaces, especially if the child's awake and or moving, with less the attractiveness of the pigtail catheters.
Sure. What about pain control and sedation when you're doing these procedures? Paul, do you have a approach you use?
Yeah, that's huge, especially in young kids. They're not able to stay still. They don't know what's going on. And so what I frequently reach for is sedation in the form of ketamine and definitely having plenty of lidocaine available. If you're the one doing it, it's really prudent to have your ED colleagues at the head of the bed just doing airway monitoring in case they crash from the sedation or the rapid lung re-expansion.
Sure. And oftentimes these children present with their parents, right? And you're about to do a major procedure on them. So how do you communicate with them?
Yeah, perhaps this is one of the most important parts of a chest tube. It's important to not blow that off. A chest tube is something that we've all done hundreds of times. And to us, it's a simple, straightforward procedure and usually pretty clearly indicated. But to parents, a tube sticking out of their child's chest, it's a big deal, and it should be. And so you've got to explain what you plan to do, talk about what you're going to do to mitigate pain, the purpose of the tube, how long you expect it to be in, what you're going to do to monitor. And although it's a rule for every procedure, it's that much more important in a pediatric patient.
Yeah. Dr. Cox, anything else you have to add over years of placing these and watching residents place them that you want to share?
Yeah, I think for the smaller kids, even though the silicone tubes are like for certain circumstances, there are some things that you need to consider when you're placing those, meaning the way the tubes are secured to the chest. The reason is a lot of these kids, they go upstairs and they're in their bed and they do this alligator roll in their bed. And then you come out on rounds and the chest tube is in a knot. And so that's a dangerous, potentially dangerous situation where you've got this twisted chest tube that's no longer draining either the air or fluid that you're trying that for presumably was placed. And it's a preventable problem.
Yeah, it's good stuff. All right, let's bring this home. Next scenario. Paul, you're back in the hot seat. A three-year-old girl spills a pot of hot tea on her upper chest and arm. She's screaming in the trauma bay. Nurses estimate she has around a 9% TBSA burn. Her heart rate is 150. Her blood pressure is 92 over 60. She gets some morphine. The burns are dressed and she's sent to the pediatric floor with maintenance fluids. 2 hours later, the intern goes to round on them and she's lethargic. She's cold to the touch. She's hypotensive, oliguric. What happened?
Sounds like he underestimated her burn wounds and overestimated her, I guess, physiologic reserve. Pediatric patients, they have a high surface area to volume ratio, and so they lose heat and fluids a lot faster than adults. And then you combine that with some thin skin and poor, less advanced thermoregulation. You've got the perfect storm for shock and hypothermia, and that could precipitate even from just a small burn.
Yeah. So what's the optimal approach in this scenario?
I think it's first important to have a good estimation tool. The rule of nines, which we frequently use in adults, is a little harder to apply to kids because their heads and arms are larger than in adults. And so the London Browder chart is what I go to frequently because they have a pediatric specific one. For burns that are greater than 10%, you need aggressive fluid resuscitation. That's different than in the adult population where that cutoff is usually about 20%. Now, there's a lot of different formulas when it comes to resuscitation, but I think the takeaway for any institution or anybody that's working in pediatric trauma is to pick one and stick with it. And in addition to that, use your end markers of resuscitation. So frequently for burn patients, it's urine output, which, by the way, is greater than 1 cc per kilo per hour, but using other adjuncts for that, such as lactate, their heart rate, their blood pressure. And so in addition, for young kids, it's easy for them to get hypoglycemic and hypothermic when you're giving them large volumes of cold crystalloid solutions. So make sure you're watching their temperatures like the hawk. And when they inevitably become hypoglycemic, have a protocol or have dextrose ready or dextrose containing fluids for them.
I agree with the estimating with Lund-Browder charts, and because they're always, whatever the initial assessment was, it's almost inevitably not right. And so take the time to do that. With the medical records now, it's also a lot with pictures being able to be put into the records. It's so much more objective after they're all dressed up. You can really map that out. But I think the piece of it in terms of MPO status hypoglycemia is, I think a critical component of that is if the patient has greater than a 10% burn, even we place a Dobhoff tube, a feeding tube, and they get enteral nutrition begun just almost immediately, even during their resuscitation. And so we loathe having them NPO for if they're going back and forth to the OR, because they can end up spending half of their first 2 weeks in the hospital being NPO, which is a disaster for them in terms of physiologic stress, et cetera. We make that's part of their resuscitation, is their enteral access. The euvolemia is important, but also euthermia, right? So warmed fluids, warming blankets, warming everything is important.
Yeah. So in pediatrics, burn wounds aren't about the sole percentages so much so as it is in adults. It also depends on who it's happening to, how small that child is. We don't want to be fooled by a small looking burn. Any other take home points, Dr. Cox?
Yeah, I think that the good news is the vast majority of the ones that we deal with are scald burns, right? It's not hot tea or hot, it's ramen noodles and kupo soup. That's 80% of our, it's 80% of them. And I think that there's a small but real number of those that when you're just talking about letting them fool you, a small number of them convert and become deep partial thickness or full thickness burns. And so that's a important thing to keep an eye on.
All right, so that wraps us up on episode 1 of 2, looking at pediatric trauma on the Big T Trauma Series. Paul, thanks for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's pediatric trauma is tough.
Yeah, high stress. We appreciate Dr. Cox having you on as well. We look forward to our next episode discussing some additional scenarios.
Thanks. I appreciate the invite. Great cases and great discussion.
All right, before we end, just to remind everyone, my favorite quote, the eyes do not see what the mind does not know. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thanks for joining. Dominate the day.
This episode of Big T Trauma was sponsored by Teleflex, a global provider of medical devices. Learn more at teleflex.com.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.